3, 2, 1, Facebook.
When a stock's first day gets covered like a rocket launch.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm David Brancaccio, New York.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. It is Friday, May 18th.
Coming up, what Facebook can learn from Google's first day.
Also, when the European financial crisis comes to a patch of woods in Maryland.
And the bill for the prom comes due.
It's all just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
So Facebook started trading this morning at $38 a share. That initial market valuation means the company at the moment is worth more than $100 billion. That is more than Disney or Kraft or other established companies. So how can a free website like Facebook be worth that much? Marketplace's Gregory Warner joins us now to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Gregory, you know, everybody's saying there's no way Facebook could be worth this much. And we got to thinking, well, what if they were to just charge users a dollar a month? That would bring in some money.
Right. You were thinking, and a lot of nervous investors are thinking about this, because calculate it, just a dollar a month with that many users could net $10 billion a year,
yeah,
solve all of Facebook's money profit worries. But look, Nicholas Meir, he's a professor of marketing and social media at Chapman University in Orange, California. He says Facebook only became Facebook by being patient with monetizing the site.
Facebook has to look into ways to be contemporary, to be cool, to be with the times without being too much a money grabber that is trying to profit from you.
So they can't be cool if they're going to charge a user fee.
Right. But look, here's the other side of it. Facebook isn't free. I mean, neither is Gmail. All these sites, when we use them, we pay, but we pay in personal information
right.
That's then sold to marketers. So Eric Clemens, he's a professor at Wharton Business School. He suggests this model. Some users could choose to pay a monthly fee in exchange for keeping their data private.
Facebook is demonstrating that it does provide value. It is not justifying its operating expense through selling your confidential information, but it's indeed providing a service you can't get anywhere for free.
Of course, here's the problem with that brave new world is that the people who would most likely pay the fee are the people with disposable income whose data the advertising companies probably most want to mine.
Isn't it always like that? Marketplace's Gregory Warner, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jeremy.
When they hit ignition on Facebook stock 90 minutes into trading this morning, the event had many of the trappings of a rocket launch. The media attention, the possibility that it could go sky high or fizzle. Marketplace's Bob Moon covered many a NASA launch earlier in his career. But the question now is, can Facebook learn from Google's launch on the stock market back in 2004?
Back then, a few analysts worried that Google's revenue growth was slowing, just like Facebook's latest quarter. But as Google began trading, Marketplace's host at the time, David Brown, noted the stock opened at $85 and quickly popped by $15 more.
Admittedly, this thing was overhyped, and then the poo-pooing began. The emperor has no clothes, was the general line. Well, it now appears the emperor can afford to go on a shopping spree.
Much of the skepticism back then stemmed from doubts over Google's earnings potential, just like those now swirling around Facebook. Wedbush Securities analyst Michael Pachter recalls the search giant wasn't offering much insight into its ad model.
Google had not yet proved out what advertisers would be willing to pay for certain keywords. A lot of investors were skeptical the rates would continue to rise as they have.
News stories also questioned whether Google's popularity would inflate its stock value, a concern echoed today about Facebook. At the University of Southern California, finance professor Larry Harris predicted its shares would be oversold.
Simply because there are so many people who absolutely love Facebook and who will be buying it without regard to price.
There are also some sharp differences. Google's wide-open auction meant anybody could bid for its IPO shares. Facebook is distributing some stock through retail brokerages, but Wedbush's Michael Pachter says in reality the big bank underwriters favor big money clients.
retail investors are going to be lucky if they get a share.
Another key difference, for its IPO, Google sought to deflect privacy concerns by essentially saying, trust us, making its motto, don't be evil. Facebook is vowing to make its privacy policy as clear as possible and calls the issue a key risk factor for its business. Indiana University law professor Fred Cate says there's a much tougher playing field now.
It raises the question of what is Facebook going to be able to get away with? Certainly the privacy and security concerns are more likely to be different.
And perhaps the most striking difference, Google's IPO raised more than $1.6 billion, which seemed rich in 2004. Facebook is raising more than 10 times that. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The G8 summit of the world's richest industrialized nations gets underway this evening at Camp David in Maryland. German Chancellor Angela Merkel could be the center of attention. She's under pressure to get behind stimulus programs for Europe. Marketplace's Stephen Beard takes a look at what this might look like.
The message from Berlin is now clear. We will not pour more cash into the black hole of Greek public spending on welfare and other government services, but we will put more money in so long as it's spent on investment, on building bridges and roads and helping industry. Sources in Berlin suggest the Germans would be prepared to contribute to a 200 billion euro investment fund administered by the European Investment Bank. Simon Tilford of the Centre for European Reform is not impressed.
The problem is that the crisis is way beyond that point. A bit of additional spending from the European Investment Bank is not going to stop the rot. It's not going to address what is now a systemic credibility problem.
He says the only way to stop the crisis now is to allow the European Central Bank to back all Eurozone countries with unlimited funds. But that, he says, will be a very hard sell in Berlin. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
A couple of weeks ago, we mentioned that Greece's credit rating had been raised to B-. Not anymore. Fitch dropped it to a triple C today, now that the government has collapsed, along with the political consensus about budget cuts and return for bailout money. Also today, the leader of Greece's hard-left political party said there is little chance Europe will stop funding the country, but if that were to happen, the country will repudiate its debts.
Now to China, which the U.S. believes is dumping solar panels at below market prices in America and is hit back with a penalty of 31%. That tariff is surprisingly steep. And as Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, the reaction from China is dismay.
The U.S. decision to slap tariffs of more than 31% on Chinese solar panels will undoubtedly prompt a Chinese response, says Meng Xiangang, vice director of the China Renewable Energy Society.
If China's treated unfairly, it'll probably retaliate.
Meng says this will have a huge impact on the Chinese solar industry. He says the U.S. and the rest of the world benefit from cheap Chinese solar panels.
Chinese solar panels help protect the global environment. This tariff hike will raise the price of all solar panels, whether they're from China or not. This is very irresponsible.
But U.S. solar panel companies applauded the decision, saying that cheap Chinese solar panels have undercut their business for years, leading to lost manufacturing jobs throughout the country. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
The yield or interest rate on 10-year government bonds is near an all-time low, just 1.7%, if you can believe it. For more on what that means and why it matters, let's bring in Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. He's with us this morning from Scottsdale, Arizona. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Chris, is this low yield a sign of investor confidence in the U.S., or do we just look good compared to the rest of the world right now?
Yeah, I guess I'd call it investor confidence by default. What we're seeing this week is money flooding out of Spain, out of Greece, looking for a safe haven as they try and figure out what's going to happen to the euro.
And what is the benefit? Who benefits from these low rates?
Well, yeah, it's safety. Obviously, the Treasury benefits because the cost of borrowing here in the U.S. is lower. And then another added benefit, yesterday, 30-year fixed-rate mortgages hit an all-time low. Average in the U.S. was a little less than 3.7%.
And with the Treasury benefit there, any chance that they're going to use that for anything, start borrowing in big ways more than they already are?
Well, you know, some economists, myself included, suggest, you know, maybe the Treasury ought to do what the UK has done when rates are really low and issue 50 and 100-year bonds, lock in those rates for a long time, not have to worry about refinancing at higher levels.
And Chris, of course, we remember the rating agency S&P downgraded the U.S. credit rating last year. Is it time for them to kick us back up to AAA?
No, probably not. You know, S&P said the reason they downgraded the U.S. was because there's no long-term plan to balance the budget.
Right.
There still isn't. So I guess what we're seeing is that we're not necessarily the best, but the least worst.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
In what's seen as the most intense student demonstrations in the history of Canada, students in Quebec have been protesting hikes in tuition since the winter. Now the government there is debating emergency legislation to temporarily close some universities and to levy penalties for protesting to as much as $35,000 for individuals. That law could pass today. Joining us from Quebec City is Leo Bureau-Blouin, one of the student leaders. Good morning.
Good morning.
Give me a sense of the legislation the government is trying to pass and why you're so upset.
It's really a very restrictive law. We can protest at less than 50 meters of teaching institution. There are also some disposition that give government the power to destroy the student unions in Quebec because it gives the permission to cut the funding of the student union. So it's really a law that I think goes too far.
Now, you see this is a free speech issue, but these protests have been going on for about 10 weeks now. And I see, for instance, that just the other day, demonstrators apparently disrupted classes at Montreal University. Surely the students in those classes should have the ability to learn if they choose.
Yeah, but that's not the problem. And it's already prohibited by the law here in Quebec to block access to a teaching institution. And we think that it was not necessary to have such a big fine. And we think that this goes against our Charter of Rights and Freedom.
Give me a sense, if you would, of the increased tuition costs that students like you are being asked to pay.
We're talking about the big tuition fees increase here in Quebec because we have a long tradition of having affordable education for everyone. And we are concerned that if it costs more and more to go to university, less kids are going to go to university and we are going to be less economically competitive.
Leo Bureau-Blouin is one of the student leaders. He's speaking from Quebec. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
In Florida this week, emergency officials and weather forecasters have been meeting for the governor's annual hurricane conference. This year's meeting comes exactly 20 years after Hurricane Andrew caused $26 billion in damage across South Florida. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Hurricane Andrew morphed into a monster overnight, buzzsawing through South Florida. Frantic meteorologists waited impatiently for slow-as-molasses printers to spit out smudged hurricane maps. But things have changed.
It has come so far.
Mark Merritt worked at FEMA in the 90s and is now president of Witt Associates. He says today's computerized hurricane predictions are much better, so local officials are ordering more mandatory evacuations.
They're not making these calls based on a gut feeling. They have very good information, and they can defend that decision.
Businesses have also changed their approach. Jerry Galloway was a brigadier general in the Army Corps of Engineers when Andrew hit. He says companies used to just protect buildings. Now they also worry about their workers because...
You can repair the plant, but if the people have nowhere to live and it's 50 miles to the next big community, they're thinking of what we need to do, what temporary housing do we need to bring in.
Those plans could be put to the test soon. Hurricane season starts June 1st. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Lawmakers in Washington are debating a $642 billion defense spending bill. And one thing that will not be in it is the $45 million Technology Innovation Program. Marketplace's Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports this puts some emerging technologies on hold.
The Technology Innovation Program, or TIP, gave cash to researchers who were developing promising but still unproven technologies. One recipient was testing electronic light pulses that could find cracks in concrete or stone. Vince Cerf was one of TIP's advisors.
Bridges, buildings, highways, and things like that, which, as we know, over time disintegrate just because of use.
Cerf knows government money can be necessary to bring new technologies to market. He helped start the Internet, which got 20 years of federal support before it was a commercial success.
I regret to see this program go away. I think we should have more programs like that.
But saving TIP's $45 million every year won't solve trillion-dollar deficits, says the Concord Coalition's Robert Bixby.
Well, this may give the appearance of tough budget medicine and, you know, making hard choices. It really is not getting at the heart of the problem.
To do that, Bixby says Congress has to deal with entitlement programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If you've seen a lot of limousines in your neighborhood lately, that's probably because it is prom season. Now, the prom is supposed to be a night high school students remember forever. And this year, the bill for prom is probably going to be pretty unforgettable, too. Bridget Bodner reports.
It's prom season at the Mint Collection. High schoolers come and go and everywhere. Flouncy neon cocktail dresses, beaded minis, even a few feathery gowns.
I don't know, it's pretty.
Claudia Thompson was shopping with her daughter. 2 years ago, the single mom was unemployed and relied on family members to help make ends meet. Claudia wants her daughter's senior prom to be a special night.
If it would have taken place back then, I think I would have worked at McDonald's if I had to, but would have given her the same as I'm giving her now.
Mom Claudia has already shelled out more than $700 on prom so far. That's just for tickets and a dress. She still needs to buy her daughter shoes, hair, makeup, flowers, transportation, dinner, pictures. Claudia's got a long list, and she's not alone. Visa estimates the average family will spend over $1,000 on prom this year. That's up a third from the year before. Paula Rosenblum is with Retail Systems Research. She's not surprised by the extra spending.
We've gone through uncertain times for so long that a certain amount of frugality fatigue has set in. And consumers really would prefer to open up their wallets and enjoy themselves, particularly on special life events like a prom.
Back at the boutique register, Tressa Matthews had just opened her wallet, spending $600 on her daughter's dress.
It's unbelievable to me how much things are now and what the expectation is in terms of how much to be spent and what this night is for these kids. Like, it's a little out of hand.
In fact, she spent $100 more than she'd planned. But her daughter, Sage Gregory, had fallen in love with a long gold dress.
Like, it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to spend more. But, I mean, this is also my senior prom, so it's kind of more special.
Sage says she's looking at it like she's helping the economy.
Because I feel like you need to, what's the word? When you activate the economy, what is that?
Stimulate
the economy. That's what I think of that I'm doing.
The sales staff at the Mint Collection offered another reason the price of prom is up. Most of the dresses are made in China. Factories there are charging more for labor this year. And designers are passing along the cost. In Los Angeles, I'm Bridget Bodner for Marketplace.
By the way, if you want to tell us how much you spent on your prom, go to the APM Marketplace Facebook page and let us know.
And finally, Jeremy, did you see Iran is threatening to sue Google?
Privacy concerns?
No.
Antitrust?
Nope. The problem is Google Maps, apparently. That region from Kuwait on down through the Strait of Hormuz is no longer labeled. Iran says it should be called the Persian Gulf. Nearby countries prefer the Arabian Gulf. A spokesman for the Iranian Foreign Ministry says if the name is not put back, Google will face, quote, serious damages. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.